Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science, and then we're going to bring on our special guest today. We're very delighted to have with us Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he has a very disturbing book, which is quite appropriate for these strange times. The book is called Flooded Earth. That is, with global warming, are we going to see not just bizarre, strange weather patterns, but also a rise in sea level that will inundate some of the great cities on the planet Earth? And so once again, our special guest is Peter Ward, professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, talking about his book, Flooded Earth. But first, let's jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The lead story today concerns the weather, this bizarre weather pattern that is sweeping across the United States and the rest of the world. Did you know that March, the month that just passed, March goes down as the hottest month ever recorded in the history of science? And that goes back to around 1895, when accurate records were kept for the first time. The hottest month ever recorded. And did you know that the last decade, the decade ending in 2010, came down as the hottest decade ever recorded in the history of science? Do you begin to notice a pattern? A pattern that not only do we have this bizarre weather patterns around the country, but we have a heat spell. In fact, just a few days ago, it was 20 degrees above normal here in New York City. And in fact, this is now beginning to affect the national debate and maybe even the presidential elections. If you poll the American people about global warming over the last several decades, it oscillates, with a certain number of people saying, well, I don't know about that. The scientists aren't quite agreed about it, so I reserve judgment. However, public opinion is shifting. In fact, this year, because of the heat spell, overwhelmingly, the American people are saying, yes, something strange is happening with the weather. Definitely, the Earth is beginning to heat up. Now, just remember that a few years ago, we had a Watergate scandal within the scientific community when hackers hacked into the emails of meteorologists. Now, let's be fair about this. Meteorologists are human. Therefore, they have human jealousies and human arguments. And so a lot of the pettiness went out on the web, and then the media blew it up as if there was a scientific debate about the merits of global warming rather than just priority fights, and you said this and I said that. So that took a beating. In opinion polls across the United States, they showed that the American people began to rise in skepticism concerning global warming. However, because this spring has been so strange, arriving a month before, well, people's opinions are changing, and now it's swinging the other direction. And you have to realize that this has consequences. People say the early bird gets the worm. However, what happens when the cycles of birds and the cycles of worms don't mesh with each other? When the cycles of nature don't mesh with each other, this means that we could disrupt the fabric of nature itself. For example, take a look at insects. One reason why a lot of insects' eggs die is because of winter time. And that's one reason why, as you go further north, we don't see that many mosquitoes and other kinds of pests. However, as the earth gets warmer, it means that the cold is not going to kill that many larvae and eggs, meaning that more pests will be bothering us come spring and summertime, which has enormous implications not just for the average suburbanite with a home, but also for farmers as well. Now, have you ever noticed that the seasons themselves are changing along with weather patterns, like tornadoes? We've had monster tornadoes ripping right through Dallas, ripping right through the heartland of America. What's behind that? Well, if you take a look microscopically at the weather, you have to admit that we scientists don't know the answer. Science, especially meteorology, is not that predictive when it comes to the weather. However, when you look at the overall trend, you see something very interesting. And first of all, tornadoes are byproducts of thunderstorms. The more severe the thunderstorms, the more probability you're going to have tornadoes spinning off. And these thunderstorms, in turn, are caused by the collision of two air masses. First of all, we have the warm, moist air coming in from the Gulf of Mexico. That's plowing into the cold jet stream coming in from Alaska and Canada. And at the juncture between these two collisions of air masses, that's when we have rain, that's when we have snow, and that's where we have tornadoes. In fact, that's the origin of Tornado Alley. Look at a map, and you'll see that Tornado Alley is precisely the corridor where these two gigantic masses of air collide. And would you know it? It turns out that the Caribbean has been hotter than normal. That means more moisture being put into the air because of the rising temperature in the Gulf of Mexico. And also the jet stream has been more erratic recently, and that's also contributed to the strange weather that we've been having. Now, some people say, is this the smoking gun? Well, no. However, if you take a look at the overall trend, all the trends are up, one after the other. The recession of the glaciers, the hottest temperatures recorded in the history of science, bizarre weather patterns where we have swings, droughts in one area, and then flooding in another area. All these are indicative and consistent with global warming, though, let's be fair about it, it is not the smoking gun. And also, speaking about catastrophes like tornadoes, have you noticed that earthquakes also seem to be increasing? Some people think that, well, maybe somebody up there is angry at us. Not only did we have the monster 9.0 earthquake that devastated Japan last year, but just 2 weeks ago in Indonesia, another massive earthquake ripped the ocean floor off the coast of Indonesia. Now, thank goodness, a tsunami. Tsunamis occur when we have earthquakes in the bottom of the ocean, but if the two plates slide horizontally with respect to each other, there is no tsunami. Tsunamis occur when there's an uplift or a depression in these gigantic land masses below the ocean floor. And so you have to realize that, for example, the San Andreas Fault, the famous fault in California, we have the sliding of two plates. If that happened underwater, you would not have a tsunami. So fortunately, we did not have a monster tsunami in the Indonesian earthquake just a few weeks ago. However, it is cause for concern. Why? Because the population of the Earth is spreading. Is somebody up there angry at us? Well, probably not. The reason why we have more people affected by these earthquakes is because, well, not because we have more earthquakes, but because we have more people spreading into areas that were once lightly populated. For example, 100 years ago, when we had the San Francisco earthquake, San Francisco was not that densely populated. Now, if you have a San Francisco earthquake like that, it would be a monster earthquake. People are moving into areas which are seismically active, where not that many people lived before. Plus, we have CNN everywhere amplifying it, so it does appear as if earthquakes are more frequent, when actually they are not at all. In fact, about once a month, we have a Category 7 or higher earthquake somewhere on the planet Earth, about once a month. Now, how come you don't hear about this? First of all, many of these earthquakes take place in the bottom of the ocean. Second, many of these earthquakes take place where there's no CNN and no great cities. As a consequence, the magnitude of these earthquakes is not magnified on the national media. We simply don't see CNN reporters going to the earthquake zone because, well, there are no people there. And speaking about disasters, did you know that just about 2 weeks ago we had a monster solar flare that just missed the planet Earth? We dodged the bullet, but one day, it's going to hit with enormous consequences. First of all, every 11 years, the North Pole and the South Pole of the Sun flip, believe it or not. And the reason for that is because the Sun is not solid. If the Sun were solid, then the North Pole would be the North Pole, and the South Pole would be the South Pole, and that's it. End of story, period. However, the Sun is kind of squishy. It's a plasma. As a consequence, the outer layer spins faster than the inner layer, and therefore the magnetic field lines begin to wind up like the windings of a clock. If you wind a clock too much, then eventually, all the springs leap out, and it goes back to normal again. Same thing with magnetic field lines. After 11 years, the magnetic field lines wind up like the windings of a clock and then spring back to normal. And when that happens, there's a burst of radiation every 11 years that then is unleashed into the heavens. And sometimes this radiation hits the Earth. This is the sunspot cycle. Sunspots are like rifles, believe it or not. They shoot out gigantic coronal mass ejections like bullets. Bullets aimed nowhere in outer space. Most of the time, they miss. After all, the Earth is very tiny when viewed from the sun. However, sometimes these coronal mass ejections do graze the Earth or actually hit the Earth. And remember, they were quite young to the space age. We didn't have space satellites 50, 60, 70 years ago like we do today. And in fact, even the electric age is new. We didn't have much electricity 100 years ago. And so in other words, these gigantic solar flares and coronal mass ejections have been happening since antiquity, even before humans arrived on the scene. But we didn't care, because we didn't have iPods and iPads and GPSs and computers. Now we do. And back in 1859, we did have a huge impact that wiped out telecommunications. Many telegraph wires were basically shorted out or disrupted. The aurora borealis, caused by solar flares going down the North Pole, was actually seen as far south as Cuba. In fact, according to reports, you could read the newspaper at night by the light of the northern lights in Cuba back in 1859. That's called the Carrington event. And if we have another Carrington event next year, perhaps in 2013, all hell could break loose. First of all, satellites would be disrupted. Our satellites are not braced to handle this kind of disruption, which means that your television could go out, the internet, GPS, weather satellites, modern telecommunications could go on the blink. Then power stations could get overloaded like they were back in 1859. In fact, many telegraph wires back in 1859 operated all by themselves. You didn't have to energize them because there was so much electricity coursing down these telegraph wires. Well, the same thing could happen again, except this time it would cause power plants to blow out, meaning you would have blackouts. Now, usually blackouts are fixed in a day or so because rescue crews and repairmen come in from the outside. Well, now there is no outside, because they too had their electricity knocked out. We could see perhaps thousands of cities blacked out simultaneously. And in fact, after that, we could have food riots because of the fact that refrigerators are on the blink. How long does food last without refrigeration? Just a few days. The supermarkets are closed, and we could even have food riots as a consequence. The physicists at the American Physical Society, the largest organization of physicists in the United States, and I'm a member of the society, we calculated that property damage in a maximum case, again, a maximum case, would be $2 trillion. That's trillion with a T, not billion. And we said it would only cost a few hundred million to fix it up. We could create redundant systems, shielding. We could ground many electric components. We could brace them, reinforce them for a few hundred million. Unfortunately, Congress simply turned their nose at us and basically gave us nothing. So we are a sitting duck if one day, who knows when, a solar flare hits the Earth and bingo, we have simultaneous blackouts across the planet Earth itself. And speaking about the space program, the space shuttle, as we all know, has been canceled. But one of the last hurrahs is where the carcass of the space shuttle is going to wind up. And it's been making news. One of the space shuttles will wind up here in Manhattan, right opposite 42nd Street near Times Square. And it'll be placed near the Intrepid aircraft carrier. And so we'll have one last look at the space shuttle. And it's kind of sad because, well, let's be blunt about it. The manned space program is out the window. President Barack Obama has often talked about the Sputnik moment. We need to create a Sputnik moment for young children to get them interested in science. Well, that's nice, but there's a problem. You see, President Barack Obama canceled Sputnik. By canceling the manned space program, we're not going to have a space shuttle to thrill young people. There's no space shuttle. There's no moon program. That was canceled. And the Mars program was canceled as well. That's a triple whammy. And who picks up the slack? The Russians. We're going to be hitchhiking on Russian booster rockets to the International Space Station. Now, isn't that ironic? Remember the Cold War? When we went toe-to-toe, head-to-head with the Soviets, it was a battle of life and death as to who would dominate outer space and who would put their flag on the moon first. Who would have thought? I don't think anyone would have thought back in the 60s that the space race would wind up with us hitchhiking on Russian booster rockets. Who would have thought? Now, to be fair, there are budget cuts. Massive budget cuts, and the space program has to have its cuts as well. But remember the benefits that we got also from the space program, the micro-miniaturization of computers, which in turn created this gigantic computer and telecommunications industry. A lot of that technology came out of the space program, not to mention weather satellites, telecommunications, GPS. All sorts of things came from outer space. Society would be thrown decades back into the past if we didn't have a space program. However, it is kind of sad to see, though, the carcass of this space shuttle being placed on display. And let's hope, as President Barack Obama has stated, that private enterprise can pick up the slack. Now, private enterprise is experimenting with the Falcon rocket, and, well, we'll have to wait and see whether or not private enterprise can launch astronauts into outer space. In the meantime, we're relying on the Russians. On one hand, hopefully that'll promote relations, good relations between these two powers. However, it is kind of sad realizing that billions of dollars were spent and this is the end product, hitchhiking on Russian booster rockets. Who would have thought? Well, next on Exploration, Flooded Earth by Professor Peter Ward. I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Peter Ward. He's a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is rather disturbing and is hitting the bookshelves this week. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Now, on Exploration, of course, we've had programs about global warming. We've talked about the effect on population and on agriculture and on tropical diseases. But here's a book that talks specifically about how our cities, some of our major cities, will go underwater or may have to be abandoned because of global warming. The book is controversial. However, it gives you a frame of reference as to what scientists are thinking if sea levels continue to rise, not 1 foot, 2 foot, but 5, 6, 7, 8 feet above normal. What happens to our great cities? What about warfare between nations when national borders begin to collapse because of mass migrations of hundreds of millions of people? Something to think about. Once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth.
Much more fun project. I've been in Rare Earth with Don Brownlee. I'd rather do astrobiology.
Oh, but well, I actually interviewed you, either you or Brownlee, I forgot.
Yeah, you did. And it just seems to be a happier topic to me to put my head in the sand, but unfortunately, I don't think we can do that much more.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Okay, well, the engineer gave us the go-ahead, so let's start with the first question. Oh, the first question that we always ask our guests is, how did you, as a youth now, get interested in science? So I'll lead off with that question. So, dig back to the cobwebs and think about what it was as a child that set you off in the direction of science. Okay, so the engineer said we're going to start in 10 seconds with that first question about you as a youth. Professor Ward, you're a professor of biology and earth and space science at the University of Washington in Seattle. However, as a youth, what steered you in the direction of science?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I think scientists know from an early age that they're going to be scientists, so it was indeed youth. What got me going were dinosaurs. My mother and father were from New York. I grew up in Seattle. We didn't have a single dinosaur skeleton, and so I was given this guilt treatment that I had to be in Seattle, and it's my fault or something that there were no dinosaur skeletons, but that got me going.
Okay, and that set you off, and how did you get interested in astronomy and Earth and space science?
Well, I certainly started in paleontology, so I was looking at my feet all the time down at the ground. But it became evident, I think, in the first part of this century, or really the end of the 20th century, that there was a great deal to learn about life in space, and especially how other Earth could be constructed from what we knew in our own Earth history. And so deep Earth history can inform us about astrobiology, and in the book I've just done now, it is deep Earth history which can inform us about what climate change is capable of.
Okay, well, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. So let's start with the ice caps. The North Polar region, over the past 50 years, since submarines have visited the North Pole, seems to have decreased by 50% just in the last 50 years. So what is your projection of the North Pole and also Greenland going into the future?
Well, the great dream of the Europeans coming to North America was for the Northwest Passage. I mean, this was a driving impulse to try to find a quick trade route to China. We're going to have that. But what I really didn't understand thoroughly enough was the difference between an ice cap and an ice sheet. All of the North Polar ice cap can melt away, and it will have no effect, essentially, on sea level. It is the ice on land, the ice sheets, which are the biggest of which, of course, are Greenland and in Antarctica. Anything that melts on those goes directly into the ocean and raises the level of it. And the biggest, scariest scenario is equivalent to what we call an ice sheet collapse. So imagine you have a cup of really warm water and then dump in about 10 or 15 ice cubes. And up goes the level of that water really fast. Well, that is the scenario for a ice sheet collapse in Antarctica.
Okay, well, we've heard about what's happening in the North Polar region, but in the South Pole, we have huge chunks of ice breaking off. But what does that mean, given the fact that most of the South Pole seems stable, at least temporarily?
You know, I've come back from two separate trips to Antarctica over the last 2 years, and we're looking at deep time events of the climate down there, but you can't help but notice what's going on all around you. It was melting like crazy. When you have both kinds of ice down there. You've got floating ice, which, again, if that melts, doesn't matter. But you've also got all this ice on land. When it melts, the water goes down to the ice rock contact, of course, and that acts as a lubricant. So when you have really anomalous warming, stuff that is on the edge of this can calve off into the ocean. That causes great global change in terms of sea level rise.
Okay, and talking about sea level rise, doesn't the heating of the Earth itself cause expansion of warm water, which causes the sea level to rise? Just the sheer fact that the Earth is warming up.
It sure does. And matter of fact, if we stopped all emissions right now, we just went completely emission neutral, the ocean is still going to rise in its level because of thermal expansion. There's been so much warming already that the ocean has a lag effect, but over the next 40, 50 years, we could expect nearly a 3-foot sea level rise if, based on the temperatures that we have now and the continued warming, just from the thermal expansion, no ice at all.
Okay, 3-foot rise without any ice, and I guess for every 1-foot vertical that you lose, how much horizontal seacoast do you lose?
Well, the seacoast itself is affected more strongly by storm surge. And you can think of storm surge as equivalent to going off a diving board. You jump off a diving board at a given height, but if you bounce a couple of times, you go way higher. It's as if you have a launching platform as sea level rises. The storm surge, which are the nasty big waves that rise higher than normal sea level, can hit coasts. But the sideways movement of the ocean is far more serious in terms of what its salt does. basalt goes laterally quite easily, and depending on the type of soil, it is the salinization of the sea level crops that I think is the greatest single danger from sea level rise. It's stunning how much of the world's productivity, and especially the rice regions in Southeast Asia, are on deltas. A delta is built out from a river hitting a calm ocean. If you have a 3-foot sea level rise, every delta on this planet will disappear. We're talking about the Nile, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, and these are all enormously productive areas. So this is the big blow that is coming. The equation is we're going to have a rise in sea level at the same time we have a rise in human population. As you know, we're at 6.6 billion now, but we're heading towards 9 billion. And this, too, is built into the system. It's kind of like the warmth of the ocean. We could do tremendous birth control efforts now, but we're probably still going to hit that 9 billion. So the intersection of 9 billion with reduced agricultural yields because of the sea level rise is the scariest aspect.
Okay, well, let's assume that we do nothing. That is, we simply treat everything as normal. We keep on spewing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Let's take the world 2050. In 2050, what will coastal cities like Boston, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, what will they look like if we just keep spewing carbon dioxide in the air as if there was nothing wrong, and we project 50 years into the future?
Well, 2050 is still not going to be apparent that we're in a crisis. It's kind of like watching a speed car as it leaves the Indy 500. If you catch it in the first 10 feet or so, it's not going very fast. But acceleration is an interesting thing. It will be apparent to all city planners in 2050 that something new is going on, and they won't like it. Much of city infrastructure is now buried. People put down, obviously, all the sewage, but now so much of the electrical and advanced communication systems are underground. They were not engineered for salt water. They were engineered for fresh water. Bringing a lot of salt into city infrastructure is going to be a huge headache. It's also going to be a headache for trying to keep freshwater reservoirs going and freshwater aquifers. So 2050 is the time when the alarm bells are going to be ringing. The populace isn't going to see much. It might only be a foot rise by then, but certainly there will be urban red lights going off like crazy.
Well, that completes the first part of our interview with Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology at the University of Washington in Seattle. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. And once again, you may also want to pick up a copy of my latest book. It's called Physics of the Future, 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, it was among the top 10 books, the top 10 nonfiction books sold in the United States of America. And it was the number one science book in this country, Physics of the Future. Get a copy. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Peter Ward of the University of Washington at Seattle, author of an explosive new book hitting the stands right now, even as we speak. The book is called The Flooded Earth, our future in a world without ice caps. So what would it be like in a world where we lose Venice, we lose Miami, we lose Bangladesh, we lose the Mekong Delta? What happens when perhaps nuclear weapons are used to prevent mass migrations, which will inevitably happen as entire nations become flooded and realize that 50% or so of the world's population lives next to the ocean, many of them in megacities? What happens when some of them go underwater? So once again, the book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Think about it and then ask yourself a question. How far are you from the ocean, and what is your height above sea level? Well, in New York City, a few years ago, we had a gigantic nor'easter which sent a surge of water into Manhattan, which flooded the subway system. And it was not even a very big storm that did that. And some people think that storm surges, even before sea level rise goes to catastrophic levels, storm surges could paralyze the electrical, the plumbing system, and the infrastructure of a city. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, storm surge is definitely the most dangerous short-term effect of this. Look, we saw what storm surge did to New Orleans. It wasn't so much the hurricane itself, Katrina, that battered New Orleans. It was the storm surge. And once again, your storm surge comes from a mean sea level. When you keep raising that mean sea level, storm surge goes up, way up, higher. The most endangered creatures are therefore freshwater plants. And what I'm really breaking my heart is trying to think what's going to happen to the Everglades. You've got this enormous freshwater biosystem, which will be so threatened by both storm surge and simply rise in sea level. You cannot live in salt water if you're a freshwater plant. And unfortunately, no saltwater plant, like a mangrove, makes food that humans can eat.
Something to think about. Now let's turn the wheels of time to 2100. What will the great cities of the world look like in 2100?
Well, 2100, there will be 3 feet, only 3 feet if we're lucky, and 5 to 6 feet if we're not lucky. And by lucky, I mean we turn off the lights right now. If it is business as usual, and I suspect it might be because of the increased population numbers, there will be that 3 to 5 foot. The most hard hit will be the wharves. Global transport by ship is still the main means of moving great amounts of food around. CNN projected when I was in Antarctica a few months ago that even a 1 foot rise in sea level will cause shipping terminals and ports and dock heights to have to be modified. And their projection was $1 trillion or more by about 2040 just to spend on the docks. Now, San Francisco Airport, I've landed on that airport over and over and over. A 3 to 5 foot sea level rise in the Bay Area will remove that airport entirely. And so just from the economic points of view, that 3 to 5 foot sea level is going to cause such an enormous financial burden on coast cities.
Okay, the big question, will cities have to be abandoned if sea levels continue to rise 3 to 5 feet? And which cities are we talking about?
Well, we've done a lot of projections on this, and I've been talking to some Dutch engineers. The consensus, and again, this is really just consensus of people looking forward, is that civilization and the cities now could probably absorb a 3 foot, 4 foot, even at the worst case scenario, a 5 foot sea level rise, and survive. But anything above 5 to 6 feet for a lot of cities is not survivable. New York has high ground. It can simply move back, but Miami cannot. Miami is, I think, the poster child of the type of city that will disappear, as Galveston, Texas will, much of the South Florida cities will, and the Netherlands, of course, is in huge trouble. They already have a significant, I think it's 30% of their land area, is already under sea level, and they spend an appreciable amount of their GNP on dikes every year, dikes and the equivalent of dikes, sometimes big sandbars. When global economy gets hit hard, it affects everybody, and I think that's what's coming.
Well, what about Boston? Large parts of Boston were reclaimed since the Revolutionary War. If you look at old maps of Boston, large parts of Boston didn't exist until recently. So what's going to happen to Boston?
Yeah, all reclaimed parts of cities are going to go away. The same with my city of Seattle. Our entire bay, Elliott Bay it's called, there's an island. Our major shipping port is an island built up from reclaimed sediment, just as Boston is. And once again, the 3-foot sea level rise allows storm surge, the big storms, to come whipping in and remove a lot of that sediment. You're not going to be able to hold that together. So any city with reclaimed sediment construction, and lots of the airports in Asia, and especially in Japan, they've been building airports out on the water. China's just done it too. All those things will have to be rebuilt somewhere else.
And what about San Francisco, Los Angeles, and especially what's going to happen to New Orleans, where large parts of the city are actually under sea level?
I think New Orleans will have to be abandoned ultimately. It might be a century or two. San Francisco is very interesting. They're very progressive engineers down there. And believe it or not, they have a plan for building a dam right under the Golden Gate Bridge that would save every one of the Bay cities. You could hold off sea level rise by building this dam. Otherwise, it's going to be a whole series of smaller dikes and systems and try to save what you can and lose what otherwise. Los Angeles is in an interesting position, too, because the city itself has obviously a lot of high ground, but there are very low-lying areas in Los Angeles that, again, will be inundated to the point that some huge storm comes, salt water is pushed way inland through storm surge, killing off the plants that are there. And then what do you do when you're living in a house that is flooded out by not freshwater, salt water? A saltwater flooding event is way worse than a freshwater flooding event.
And what about London, where we have gigantic underwater devices to help control the water of the Thames River? Are we all going to be like that? Are we all going to be like the little Dutch boy putting our finger in gigantic dikes that we're going to build around our cities? What are we going to do about this?
Well, the British have thought a lot about sea level rise, too, and they are planning on contingencies for up to 5 feet. And you just really hit it. They're thinking about what sort of engineering do we have to do to save our cities? Historic cities, such as London and any of the cities in the Mediterranean, will do everything and anything to try to keep their shorelines as they are now. But it really all depends on where we can stop this. Look, if we melt every single glacier on the planet, we have a sea level rise of over 200 feet. That was the case less than 17,000 years ago. We know from the deep past that when carbon dioxide has been 1,000 parts per million, there is no ice sheet. And we're at 380, 390 and climbing. It's just that to me is the spookiest aspect of it all.
Okay, and what's going to happen to growing areas of the world? Like California has the San Joaquin Valley. Other places have gigantic growing areas. What happens when salt water begins to intrude upon these growing areas?
Agriculture becomes very dicey. Obviously, the San Joaquin Valley is enormously threatened. 20 years ago, it was already recognized that there's salt creeping in. Once again, if sea level goes up a little, salt goes sideways a whole lot. And any sort of salt within your soil reduces productivity and ends to the point that you can no longer grow crop plants. So this San Joaquin Valley itself is endangered. The northern Sacramento Valley is in trouble. And as I mentioned earlier, every delta on the planet and all that rice from Southeast Asia, those are the targeted places that we should worry about most agriculturally.
Okay, and well, let's be very specific. I live in Manhattan. Manhattan is a little bit above sea level. The place where I am is about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet above sea level. However, certain parts of Manhattan are very close to sea level. Wall Street, for example. So what is Manhattan going to look like, and are we going to have to use a system of dikes to prevent the flooding of Manhattan?
Yeah, there will have to be some sort of mitigation going on in Manhattan. If not for the sea level rise itself, certainly for the storm surge. Again, a small level storm surge is the takeoff point a small level sea level rise is the takeoff point for storm surge. And in my book, I actually did some elevation counts for various areas and various streets in New York, and not off the top of my head. I actually projected winners and losers in mm-hmm. New York City and its boroughs.
Okay, and let's talk about Venice. Engineers have seriously looked at the problem of Venice. San Marco Plaza, the famous plaza, is actually underwater for parts of the year. So what have we learned by trying to do these gigantic engineering projects like for Venice?
Well, Venice is really interesting because they're putting out into the bay that Venice faces what is sort of a non-traditional dike in a way. It's not like a single wall that the little Dutch boy can put his finger in. But what is interesting and sort of alarming for Venice is also in Holland, it's not just the sea level rise, but it's the fact that the river's behind yourself. These big cities were often built upon rivers. And because we've got global warming, it's not snowing in many of the mountains, in the Alps and in the Sierra, for instance. Snow level is higher. And so instead of snowing in the winter, it rains. And these rivers rise at times they never used to rise before. So Venice is fighting a two-front war, as is many of the Dutch cities. You have to worry about the river that runs through you as much as the sea coming at you. And as any of the military geniuses said, two-front wars are often hard to win.
So Venice may have to be abandoned at some point, you figure?
I would suspect, yes.
Okay, and your book goes beyond 2100, goes to 2300 and beyond. So what is the coastline of the world going to look like now beyond 2100? If I have a map of the world, what will school children see? The North Pole gone? The coastline changing? What will the Earth look like beyond 2100?
Well, it really boils down to some simple geology. Continents, as we know, move around. In the direction that they move, like North America's west coast, there are high mountains generally. But trailing edges, we call them passive edges, don't have mountains, or they have mountains that eroded away, as our east coast does. So you've got the enormous Gulf Plain, you've got the enormous east coast plain in front of the Appalachians. There'll be inroads all through that. The problem that we see is that most estimates and models think up to 2100 and stop. But at 2100, if it's business as usual, say we kept it at 3 feet, it doesn't stop there. It keeps going in accelerated fashion. So if you have 3 to 5 feet by 2100, it's not going to mean that you would have twice that by 2200. You could have three times that high. The acceleration is the most ominous aspect of this business.
So let's just do a computer program. Assume that at some point we stop greenhouse gases into the future, but we just let the computer program run. What will the world look like? Will all the great cities be underwater by then, by 2200, 2300?
No, ice sheets in Antarctica, they are thinning, and they're thinning in both Greenland and Antarctica. A great deal of that water is going in, but the ice sheets are enormously thick in both places. Greenland is far more endangered than Antarctica is. You're not going to see wholesale flooding of the cities by 2200 or even 2300, which possibly gives us time, but you're certainly going to see effects where the cities that will have to be abandoned, I think that will already be taking place. We just have to maintain these ice sheets with as much integrity as we can, and that means slowing the global warming temperatures, which seem to be inexorable. Look, we just went through this huge recession. We should have had 2 or 3 years because of the economic downturn, when emissions could have been or should have been reduced. They weren't. I mean, they're right up at the IPCC's maximum emission prediction. We're not lowering emissions. We're increasing emissions.
Okay, now let's go into the past. You can do that because we can drill into the ice cap and get ice cores from thousands of years ago. 10,000 years ago, we had the Ice Age. It was very cold, 10,000 years and beyond that. So how far back in time do you have to go to find a time similar to what we're going to be experiencing in the future? And what did the world look like at that time?
Well, the conventional answer is that if we get up to 1,000 parts per million, which would happen in 2 centuries from now, if we have some sort of control on emissions, a lot of us think that 1,000 parts per million would be a lot sooner than that. But you're going all the way back to a time called the Eocene, And the Eocene was a very interesting time when we had crocodiles up on the North Pole. We had palm trees in Seattle. We just had this wonderfully tropical climate. The bad news is that sea level was 240 feet higher than it is now because there was no ice. There were no ice sheets at all on the planet.
And when was that?
This was about 50 million years ago, mm-hmm. but we only have to go back 110,000 years ago to see a world where sea level was at least 10 feet higher than now. Mm-hmm. And there's great evidence of this in Florida. In the Florida Keys, there's a beautiful quarry in Windley Key. It's a national park. And you can see big coral heads sitting 4 or 5 feet above sea level. Now, if you go offshore with your mask and flippers, you find the same corals, big Montastria they're called, living down about 10 feet deep. That's the shallowest they can live. So here is evidence, and we can date these with radiometric dating, that 105, 110,000 years ago, sea level was 10 feet higher than it is now, and the entire geography of that place was different. What caused that short-term rise, and this was a blip in the Ice Age, was orbital changes. But at the same time, we had a slight increase in carbon dioxide, and these two conspired to cause a great melt enough to produce a 10-foot rise in sea level.
Uh-huh, 10-foot rise in sea level. So the ice caps, they disappeared 150,000 years ago?
Well, we have very little fossil record of what an ice cap shape looked like because mm-hmm. it's floating ice. It doesn't leave any record of itself in sedimentary rock. But we have pretty good evidence on if there's an ice sheet because of the scratches and striations that moving ice produces. You can date some of these surfaces and get an idea about the direction of the ice and even in many cases the thickness of the ice depending on how deep the grooves were.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a pretty good sense of when there was ice and when there wasn't.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about mass migrations and how that could affect world politics. We've had Peter Schwartz of the Global Business Network on our show, and Peter Schwartz is a consultant for the United States Pentagon. And the Pentagon asked the Global Business Network a very simple question. What does global warming mean for the military? What kinds of military conflicts could arise because of global warming? And they looked at the maximum case, and the maximum case shows that you could have mass migrations of not just a million, but tens of millions, maybe even hundreds of millions of people. Look at the situation in Bangladesh, for example. And at that point, national borders could begin to crumble. How do you stop 10 million people from crawling all over your national borders? And what will nations do at that point? At that point, according to the Global Business Network, nations may reach for nuclear weapons to preserve the integrity of their national borders. And they specifically looked at certain hotspots where we have two opposing nuclear powers, and then the question of what happens when borders disintegrate. So what do you think?
Well, the unfortunate thing, I never knew about the Peter Schwartz report, but 2 years ago when I started writing this book, I actually put a 5-page scenario of exactly that, of Bangladesh really collapsing under not just the fact that much of it was being inundated by salt water, but once again, it's that pesky lateral movement. It's not just that they won't have a place to live, it's that the crops fail. I mean, Bangladesh feeds itself now, but barely. But they're projected to have a gigantic population rise. At the same time, they're going to lose this 3-crop rotation per year. And so my scenario certainly sees Bangladeshis pushing into India and India pushing back militarily. Actually, I got this scenario not from the Pentagon, but the CIA several years ago did the very similar sort of assessment. And they, I think, quite presciently said, yes, sea level rise is going to cause migration of borders. One aspect of it that you may not think about right off the bat is sea level rise is going to affect not only coastal cities and coastal agriculture, but much of the transportation corridors on land occur right near or at sea level. Transportation lines, major highways, lots and lots of rail lines, these things will go out very quickly because of storm surge. So when you're talking about mass migration now, if we're the case where sea level is producing mass migration, we're probably in a world where the normal transportation infrastructure has been highly degraded. Let's put it that way.
And what about megacities? If you take a look at population rise, it's not uniform across the world. More and more peasants are leaving the farms, going into the gigantic megacities, creating gigantic megaslums, and of course, they're next to the water. So what happens when they get flooded? Where are they going to go? We're talking about hundreds of millions of people potentially being pushed out of their new home. What's going to happen then?
Well, because most megacities are surrounded in one case or another by at least small to large farmlands. I mean, it's traditionally it was the case where you had the city, you had the farms surrounding it. Agricultural land will be inundated with humans, and this just exacerbates the problem of feeding ourselves. We're really looking at a case where, look, the elephant in the room is just too many people on this planet. It's just at this stage, we have to deal with the idea that the human population can continue to do as it's doing unimpeded. Whatever happened to zero population growth, that movement in the 70s that said slow down, that has disappeared entirely, and that is the single most important part of the equation.
Okay, now that we've painted a picture of what our children, our grandkids, and our great-great-grandkids may face, then the question is, well, what are they going to say when they look back at us? What did we do to prevent this disaster from happening? So do you have any positive thoughts about what could be done, or is it inevitable?
No, actually, there's quite a bit of hope. Look, let's go back 5 years. Global warming was certainly a topic, but I would bet that you would have a hard time finding a single person on the planet now who hasn't heard in one language or another those two words strung together and have a sense of the implications. There has been an enormous amount of work to get the information out. I have to take a shot at journalists because journalism now is really based on this idea that you have a pro and a con, that every story has to have the negative side. And what makes me laugh is I can imagine somebody now doing an interview about gravity, and here's Isaac Newton. And the anti-gravity side says this. We really have to continue the sense that the word has to get out. And what I find most hopeful is I teach college kids, their generation gets it, their generation is worried, and their generation is doing things about it. And that's my sense of it, that we are going to get a hold of this thing, that we're going to find better and more alternative energy sources. We have to get off the coal habit. They keep saying we're addicted to oil, but the addiction to coal is way worse, way, way worse. And that coal is the cheapest form of energy on our planet, and it is, in a sense, centuries' worth is there. It's not like peak oil. Peak coal is centuries away.
Now, the Chinese are building one coal plant per week. Every week, a new coal plant is created in China. And to be fair, they're also creating solar panels as well. But what's going to replace coal, even if we reduce our dependency on oil, even though we go electric? Electric cars get their electricity from coal. So electric cars, in some sense, make it worse because they get their energy from coal. So what's going to replace coal?
Well, hopefully we have many things. There's not going to be any one single thing. And we're going to have to, again, I hold my nose, embrace nuclear. We're going to have to hope and pray that the experiments taking place in Berkeley in the labs there for fusion reactors work. I mean, if we can harness fusion power, boy, we're in great shape. But I think what we're going to have to find are enormous changes in lifestyle. Let's take one. We really need to erase airplane travel the way it is now. Airplanes are horrible polluters. You know, what's wrong with airships, lighter-than-air airships? What's wrong with staying home for vacation? And we scientists, we're among the worst. You know, we flip from place to place, from conference to conference. What about nice old sailing ships? You know, I bring up these ideas and people laugh at me, but can you imagine a beautiful stateroom? You've got your Wi-Fi and you've got your computer and you take 5 days to get to your conference. Things have to slow down. Things have to centralize. We need to have old-fashioned medieval cities, centralized, compressed living, circled by farms. The food you produce around you is the food you eat. That is the model for how to survive. What is the next? The big danger is the next 2 centuries. The big danger is the next century, really, with this pulse in human population.
And what reaction have you gotten? A lot of snickers and a lot of eyes rolled to the ceilings when you talk about a lifestyle of the Middle Ages?
Well, they call me Cassandra, and I get this Chicken Little over and over and over. I tried to do an op-ed piece for the New York Times, and they wrote back saying, well, we're not going to print this. And I said, why not? I said, well, it's not that we don't believe you. It's just that it's such a horrible fate that it's just not going to happen. Okay, why not? Well, it's just it can't because it's too terrible. So why scare people? Even if it's going to happen, it's too terrible. So it won't happen.
They actually said that to you?
Yeah, written. I mean, just said, nope, can't do this.
So if it's too terrible,
it makes me laugh.
If it's too terrible, it's not going to happen because it's too terrible.
Exactly. And that's pretty much what I get from most of this conversation.
And last question. If you were to estimate or take a guess as to the most likely scenario, we painted, of course, a worst-case scenario and temperatures keep on rising and so on and so forth. But if you were to then say what is the most likely scenario, what would you say?
I say the population peaks at 9 billion, goes back down to 7 and 6. I say that emissions go up to about 600, and then we bring it back down to the mid-400s.
And why do they go down again? Things don't go down for nothing.
Well, they go down because if we can reduce population, they certainly will go down. And if we can increase the efficiency of power plants, if we can bring in the solar, bring in all these possibilities, yes, they will go down. But I do think we're going to have a case where sea level, in my own estimation, sea level will certainly hit 5 or 6 feet above what it is now, and hopefully doesn't go any higher than that.
Okay, and maybe our properties will be underwater by then.
Well, if you have a view property now, it'll be a waterfront property. And if you have a waterfront property now, you could make it an underwater park.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, you've been listening to our special guest, Professor Peter Ward, Professor of Biology and Earth and Planetary Science at the University of Washington in Seattle. The book is called The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Good day.